recording for KISL 88.7. So Brandon, the first thing that hit me about this film was, you know, kind of the fact that you shot it before the earthquake, and you guys were already pursuing it. What kind of tailspin did it take your filmmaking process when all of a sudden the earthquake hit? And how did you get involved with it anyway beforehand? How did you find this guy at Princeton University?
So Patrick, the director, his last film was called The Philosopher Kings, which you can see on Netflix and Hulu now. But it was a film about kind of finding wisdom in the most unlikely of places. And so he profiled like six janitors at Ivy League schools and just kind of followed their lives and, you know, like listened to the people that no one was listening to. And Josue was one of those guys. And he was very quiet about what he was trying to do for the whole time. And then at the end of them shooting that film, he just kind of barely mentioned that, like, oh yeah, he had been working on this water project with his brother for, you know, like almost 10 years at that point, I think. And so Patrick was like, okay, what's this about? And, you know, he started to get more information about it. And just kind of then Patrick and I were trying to find a project to work on together. And so we talked a little bit about doing this. And actually Patrick had went over to Princeton and kind of started shooting a little bit of stuff. And then, you know, like we started to see what he was trying to do and started to build the blocks of kind of the film we were going to make. And then the earthquake hit, and just we lost 11 family members. And, you know, the silver lining of that was that the world became very interested in Haiti overnight. You know, Haiti before this was, you know, still the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere, but this brought, you know, like 24-hour news coverage to what was going on. And so what happened in the Princeton community was these kids that, you know, he cleans their toilet on a daily basis, he serves them, they started asking him questions. They had already kind of had a relationship with him. They started asking him questions about his hometown and what was going on and what it was like. And, you know, then it started to come out that he was trying to do this water project, and these brilliant kids just decided, you know, like, we're going to start fundraising for him. And you kind of see what happens there. It's like, you know, honestly, it's been one of the most inspirational things to show the film, and just kind of one of the messages that we hope to get out the most is to young people and students, you know, just that idea of, like, you don't have to ask anyone to do something good. You know, we find that it's, you know, like, when you're trying to do something good, it's very easy to get wrapped up in the bureaucracy of that thing and, like, oh, if we want to do this, we need to call the UN, and then we'll do this, and then we'll fundraise, where it's like, no, you just do something, you know, and go. And that's what these kids did. And then in terms of the earthquake kind of switching what we wanted to do, well, so the earthquake happened, and Patrick and I kind of looked at each other, and it was like, are we going to do this? You know, like, we kind of have to go all in. And we had no idea that at that moment when we decided to do it, we would give the next 4 years of our lives to this project. But that's kind of how documentary filmmaking goes. And then in terms of how it changed the like, what we were filming and our approach and stuff, like, you know, as a documentary filmmaker, your biggest asset is flexibility and just kind of watching and seeing where things go. And you try to have a pretty good idea of what you want to do, but it's kind of useless, you know, because it's just, this is real life and this is what's really going to happen. And just like our lives, you know, this thing goes off into tributaries all over the place. And, you know, we could have told, you know, infinite stories out of this. But that, you know, it definitely changed, like, our preparation going down there. For a little bit of time, we were talking about having to get, like, armed guards because the penitentiary fell apart. So there was thousands of criminals running around, and, you know, people were desperate. And there was, you know, there was a lot of gnarly stuff going on down there. And it's always kind of like that, I find, before you go to a country, you're nervous. And once you get there, it's like, it's fine. It's okay. And so we ended up being totally fine down there. But yeah, when we shot that earthquake stuff, when we were cutting the film, for a long time, that was like 45 minutes of the film, because it was just so hard not to include all this really, really heartbreaking and passionate and, you know, just bombastic stuff. And we had to realize that that's not what the film was about. You know, the film is about this journey, and so we had to cut it way down, but yeah.
Were you planning to help him with his project before this happened? Because, I mean, were you thinking about financing? Were you thinking about fundraising? I mean, what was the initial goal?
The initial goal was, we didn't really have a goal. You know, it was just, we knew his spirit, and we knew that we could kind of throw some kindling here and there. We didn't really have a plan yet of how we were going to do that, but, you know, it was really just like, let's see how this guy does this, and let's, you know, like, that was supposed to be the story, just how this David and Goliath thing of how this one janitor, you know, was able to save his village, kind of single-handedly. And, you know, we didn't really want to affect it too much. We knew that we could help a little bit, and we had planned on, you know, connecting Generosity Water regardless. And so there was a little bit of kindling there and you know, hopefully a little push. But we really wanted to stay hands-off and just kind of let it happen organically.
Makes sense. Now, as a filmmaker yourself, and we can talk about the Catalina Explorer project as well, how do you choose and pick your projects? Like, what made you say, I'll go with the, you know, the director and do this, or I'll go with Zach and take a 9-foot boat around Catalina Island and gale force winds?
Right. Yeah. You know, I think it's just about opportunity for me. And when things make sense, you know, with this one was a little easier because I knew that it would satisfy different parts of me as a human and an artist. Like, I could get involved in, you know, helping people and telling a story that would directly affect people, you know. And I've always, you know, it's always been hard, and I've shot documentaries overseas in kind of gnarly situations in the past, and refugee camps and situations like that. And I've always had this kind of decision to make where it's like, well, you know, am I going to feel guilty about this? Like, what should I be doing? Should I be telling this story, or should I pick up a shovel? And, you know, over the last few years, I've kind of realized that my gift is in storytelling and trying to bring this stuff to a wider audience. And it would be worthless for me to feel guilty about not, you know, baking bread and giving these people bread, or, you know, picking up a shovel or something like. So that's kind of where I was comfortable with that idea when we started this film, although it still became very challenging at certain points of this film. But yeah, like, it really, you know, it kind of satisfied me as a human completely. Yeah. And then the Catalina project was just like, I, you know, like I said earlier, I just had fallen in love with this place, and I wanted to see it from that side, and I wanted to see all the pieces that I hadn't seen before, and yeah, it's just, you know, yeah.
Yeah. So you just go with what interests you.
Yeah.
Now, it's a 4-year journey with this. For some of us that don't understand the filmmaking process, which I'm still learning as I go every day. Why does it take 4 years for something like this to actually see light? And then what's the, you know, the end result where Don Cheadle says, yes, I'll narrate it?
Yeah, you know, it's been a long, long time. And, you know, it's been very taxing in terms of life and money and all this stuff. Because one of the things was we had planned on being able to do what you call pre-production for a little bit longer, where you're fundraising, you're, you know, getting the right equipment together, you're getting the right team together. And so we started to kind of, you know, shoot stuff with Josue, and then the earthquake happened, and it was just like, we didn't have a choice anymore. We were just going. And so we all just kind of put the first trip on our credit cards and went. And, you know, the whole, from in production, we went to Haiti 5 times, I think, and for about 10 to 12 days each. And we would go to Haiti, we would come back, shoot other corporate stuff and commercials and, you know, stuff to make money, get enough money, go back to Haiti. So it was like we kind of had to piecemeal this thing together financially the entire time. And we never really had enough time to, like, put a solid pitch together for investors and, you know, like, graphs and charts and all that stuff that you need to actually show a legitimate production. So, yeah, you know, shooting went on for about a year, and then we sat down to edit it and still didn't have any money. So, you know, we're still kind of piecing this time together where we sit down and edit this film. And, you know, we had someone asked last Q&A I did how many hours of footage we had, and it's hard now because we used to have tapes that just represented 1 hour, and now it's all digital, so, you know, we had like 8 terabytes worth of footage, which is, yeah, you know, hundreds and hundreds, probably 300-ish. And so going through that, half of it is in Haitian Creole, which none of us speak, and, you know, it just became kind of this nightmare where we translated, you know, as much footage as we could afford to for our first cut. We were going for a festival deadline. That was a big mistake. We should have just translated all of it and knew what we had and edit the film. And, you know, so probably a year later after we got the first translations done, we finally raised the money to get the rest of the translations done, and it was like, what? That was in there the whole time? That's what they were talking about? Like, there's so many little moments where it's just like, it would have been nice to know that that existed. You know, and so that post-process, just, you know, documentary editing is very much like writing in narrative films. Like, you're really putting that story together at the end because you just have a bunch of stuff. And you got to sit down and make a story out of it. And so there's a lot of writing in that process, and that took a long time. And then when we got into post-production, outside of the edit, once the edit was locked, we got really lucky because we got a lot of people seeing the film and starting to get excited about it. And Skywalker Ranch, George Lucas's sound facility up in Northern California, pretty much, you know, had us come up for 2 weeks for free, and they did all the sound for us, and the color correction was almost completely free through some connections, and just, like, people really started to kind of get behind what we were doing. And then we had this list of narrators that we wanted, and Dawn was just at the top, and so we were like, let's just go for it. You know, and I wish it was a sexier story in terms of how it went down, but we literally just got a hold of his voiceover agent. And his voiceover agent just happened to have some friends who were doing some work down in Haiti. So he had a very soft spot in his heart for us because we didn't know what we were doing. We didn't know what these contracts were. Like, this is the first time that any of us had worked with A-list talent. And he was like, I don't know if you guys ever watch Entourage, but he was like Ari Golding us the whole time. Just like, this is never going to work. I'm going to kill this. Like, you guys are out of here. And it was like every time we were just learning and trying to stay afloat. And so it finally came together right before we had to go to Skywalker, and he comes in, and he does his thing, and he's a sweetheart, and he actually did the whole thing in an hour, and we learned after he left that he had literally come directly from George Clooney's house where he was playing basketball with President Obama, and so he came directly from there to our session to Marvel to start shooting Iron Man 3, all in one day. And so we were just, like, so pumped that we even got him for an hour. So, yeah, that's kind of the long of it.
That's great. And weren't you one of the first flights allowed back into Haiti after the earthquake?
Yeah, we were. There was a couple. But, yeah, I mean, we were in that first kind of wave.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Does anybody have questions for Brandon about either the Catalina Explorer project or Cliff?
Well, so Josui is, we've built a social action campaign around this film, and we're really using this film as a tool, showing it as many places as we can, because we're trying to raise about $300,000, half of which is going to build a school in Haiti, in La Source, actually, because now these kids that have spent, you know, a majority of their day in the past, 4 hours a day, 2 hours up, 2 hours back, pretty much, now have this free time to actually go to school. You know, that whole time was spent getting water. And now they have this time to go to school. So for the first time, there'll be a need for school. And we'll also be able to double that as a clinic, a medical clinic. Two of the classrooms will kind of turn into medical clinic. And then the other half of that is going to, and this is Joe Swee's like list. We're just trying to help him knock things off of his list of how he wants to transform his village. The other one is we've identified about 20 more villages that are in just as dire a need. But the cool thing about these other villages is it's like $6,500 to dig a well. And then, you know, it feeds about 500 people just like that. So, you know, that's the thing about this humanitarian crisis that we're in the middle of with the lack of clean water is it's not like the AIDS epidemic or you know, this thing that requires this immense amount of research and the most brilliant minds on the planet. Like, you know, most of the time there's a water table that's within digging distance that, you know, it has not been corrupted. And, you know, you just dig down there and provide a well that the community understands how to maintain, and there's a solution right there, you know. And so that's what we're really trying to spread, that message of just like, this is a fixable problem, and this is very quickly becoming the thing that, you know, like wars are going to be fought over in the future, and it doesn't have to be the case. That's our big thing, is trying to use the film as a tool to get as many like-minded people rallied to kind of help with this. And then my next film is actually a narrative film. I'm going to take a break from the documentary grind for a little bit and make a scripted film. And so hopefully I'll be starting that in about 9 months. So, yeah.
He also has a script about Catalina, I'm just saying.
I do.
But he
do.
Does. how has this influenced other groups around wherever, you know, the country, New Jersey, Princeton, yeah, to do different things or even help out with this project? And how has it transformed the village since?
Oh, man. Yeah.
Because it's been, what, about a year and a half?
Yeah, I guess it has been about a year and a half. So it was amazing to kind of watch Princeton just, like, hug this guy after they found out what he was doing, and after, like, he got a little bit of press within the school newspaper and stuff for the film we were doing, like, the engineering department, like, went with him to La Source and brought windmills. And so, you know, like, they're creating electricity now there. And, like, you know, they're just this school full of brilliant kids, obviously. And they're really kind of pushing towards helping him, you know, like, completely transform his village. And like I was saying with the kids, I mean, clean water is the first step out of extreme poverty. And there's no real reason to do anything else, you know. Because if you're still drinking clean water, you know, like, that is the base level problem. There's no reason for a clinic if you're still drinking clean water. There's no reason for a school if you're still, you know, having to walk up, you know, for half of your day to get water. So it's just, like, it's been amazing to kind of watch these ripple effects grow, where these kids are starting to need school and these parents kind of have more time. People aren't as sick, so they're able to, you know, garden more, like, and then they're able to use this water for their gardens, like, the way, and it's very green in the film, but now it's just, like, they're, like, producing stuff like crazy, and, like, it's just, it's had a very visual, palpable effect on the community. And, I mean, they've always been huge-hearted people and just happy and passionate, but it's been incredible to kind of see the way that it's spread.
Have there been political fights over the water? You could kind of see some of the tension.
Yeah, you know, luckily none of that really, you know, kind of boiled to the surface in a dangerous way. There was some frustration and, you know, like the communication wasn't the best with some people, so you could see that there was a little bit of stuff brewing, but, you know, with the water coming out of the spring in the mountain, they were thinking that that was going to cut off their supply for the villages above. Ended up not happening whatsoever. Everyone was able to get as much water as they needed. And then in terms of, you know, like, people always had different projects that they wanted to do. And, you know, Joe Swee and Chris Madon is kind of like the de facto mayor of the town. And so he was able to kind of just quell that. And you saw in a scene there where they're just like, a guy wants to build a road, and they're just like, no, this is what we're doing. Like, either we do it this way or we don't do it. And, you know, they really kind of had the town's support. And, you know, we just, you know, that kind of stuff is always interesting in a film in terms of, like, you know, some pushback and some conflict. So, yeah. Yeah, well, you know, they actually ask, the community, it's their project completely. Chris Madon engineered the thing from the ground up. He actually, with no formal schooling, he actually was the one who figured out what the PSI on the pipes needed to be for it to get down the mountain and back up a hill. Like, you know, this guy's a brilliant, brilliant man, and they asked that people give a little bit of money at their town meetings, as you saw in one of the town meetings, for upkeep. And we were able to keep, we were able to not spend all the money, so we gave them a pool, the rest of that money, to just kind of keep for upkeep. But they built everything, so they know how to fix it. They picked out all the, you know, like everything about it. So, and it's all stuff that's in stock in their local hardware store. So they tax it to a certain extent, but yeah, I think that that's just more of it's literally pennies, so it's just more of kind of an investment type thing. So yeah.
Infrastructure.
Yeah.
Anybody have any other questions?
Chuck Adele.
Thank you, Mr. Ron Trupa. I've often thought about when people are doing a documentary and they're aware of the fact that documented.
Right.
And I know this is sort of pretty hard to document. How much do you think your presence caused things to be different than they might have been if it was not being documented? I mean, how much of an influence does a documentation of an event have on actually what occurs rather than just standing back and photographing what would have happened if you hadn't been there in the first place?
Right. Yeah, you know, that's something that I've thought a ton about. You know, all of these days doing this. The one big thing that we really pushed for, and we got lucky because Patrick had already created a relationship and established trust with Josue throughout filming his last film. So I was able to actually... Patrick kind of had the trust relationship, and I was kind of able to just slide into the situation a little unnoticed. And so I was actually able to shoot pretty unnoticed most of the time because Patrick and Josue had this really good relationship. And Josue was so driven that he really forgot that we were there most of the time. Like, in Haiti, he would literally just jump out of the car and run away. And, you know, it's like the whole idea is that we're shooting everything and we would have to remind him, like, you know, yeah, do your own thing and, like, whatever, do what you're going to do, but maybe just, like, give us a little heads up or, like, give us a tap or something, because he's just, you know, the difference between that man in Princeton, New Jersey and in Haiti is, like, two different complete people. And when he's in Haiti, he's just, like... His whole body language changes, like he just stands up and his chest comes out and he's just like this ambassador to all of his people. And so it was very easy for him more so to forget about us in Haiti, I think, than in Princeton. But yeah, I mean, we did as much as we could and we shot with a lot of long lenses so we weren't right up in their faces when things were happening. So it'd be a distance kind of more like this. And we used wireless microphones so... we could still get sound without being connected to them. So we tried as much as we could to distance ourselves from what was happening so we could get that true stuff. But like you're saying, I think that there obviously is a certain amount of influence that happens regardless. But I think it's a documentarian's job to try to limit that as much as possible. Hopefully it would have happened regardless, but who knows? Yeah.
Again, I'm not making any, but you would think that a lot of people would participate knowing that they're going to be maybe for the first time being on camera. I'm not saying they wouldn't otherwise, but
right.
It seemed like
put certain people under pressure.
Benefit and sometimes to a detriment, it seemed like like this activity, everybody was involved, and I'm just saying, I...
Totally. And everyone was...
That's great.
Right. And the funny thing is, I'm pretty sure that most everyone in La Source had no idea what we were doing. Like, even Chris Madon, we would hear little things from Joe Sui, where it's like, he had no idea what we were doing, and we're like in there shooting him while he's praying in the morning, and he's just kind of like, what is happening? Like, I don't know what to do. And he was like, he started preaching to us at one point, and our translator was like, no, just like do your thing, and, you know, because they just didn't know. They've never, you know, really had their own television. They don't, you know, they just don't quite understand. But they were very happy about it, and they were very welcoming. In Port-au-Prince, it was a much different story because news crews had been all up in their faces since the moment that the earth crumbled. And so we were just, it was very hard to reconcile that because we were just another crew smashing a camera in their face, asking for sound bites. Of course, we weren't doing that, but that's what they thought that we were. And so it was a really hard thing as just a human and a storyteller to have to kind of feel that guilt, and there was a lot of people flipping us off and stuff, and it was just like, they didn't know what our intentions were with this footage, and you can't explain it to everyone, but it was like, I knew what I was trying to do with this, and I wasn't exploiting them, but they don't know that, and so that became a really difficult thing.
Did you take the film back there and show it to them and see?
We haven't yet. The plan is that when we break ground on the school, when we raise the money to break ground on the school, which hopefully is within the next 6 or 8 months, we're gonna bring it back and have like a blow up projector. It's kind of a whole thing because we have to bring a generator out and a blow up projector and all this stuff, and get it translated back into Haitian Creole. So we're kind of raising money for that now and trying to have all the funds ready for when we break ground at the school to be able to have a big party and show everyone the film.
And you'll probably have to dub it too, right? Because the literacy rate is probably not as high.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, we haven't even thought of that, but yeah.
Well, there you go. Yeah. I gave this up. Are there any other questions for Brandon? Yeah? Well, thank you so much. I want to say Brandon came out here completely, you know, within a week's time of me going, come on, you got to come out. And he's like, sure. It's like, I love Catalina. And, you know, just very generous with his time and wanted to come out here and share this with us. And Scott Schmeckpepper, you know, here in the church, has his orphanage in Haiti. And all the information's right out there in the front. So he was ecstatic to see this, but he couldn't be here because he's a brand new grandfather. So he flew to Texas to see his new granddaughter. And he was so excited to. So Brandon's leaving him a copy of the DVD, and he's going to leave, I think, one more. So if anybody like Mary Stein, who wanted to see this so bad, she's not here, and like a couple other people, they can probably see it through there. Plus, he just released on iTunes 3 days ago.
Yeah.
So we're getting them right when they're launching, and then maybe in a few months, Netflix and Hulu Plus and
all that stuff. Yeah, wherever you can buy digital content now, it's available, PlayStation, Xbox, all that stuff. And if you guys are interested in the kind of social action campaign and what we're doing around that, go to lasourcemovie.com and all the details are there. And you know, we have everything kind of set up for people to throw their own fundraisers, and we have like the website set up where you can set up your own fundraiser and people can donate directly to that. Like, I'm taking the film in a couple weeks to my hometown in Auburn, California, up north, and we're doing a fundraiser called Auburn for Haiti, and the people of Auburn are hopefully going to all donate enough for one well in Haiti. So we're just trying to do as much as we can with that. And if you guys are interested, lasourcemovie.com.
And it's also on the website, so if you want to go to our website, you can go straight to La Source if you don't know how to spell La Source, which means the source, and I did ask that, by the way. I was like, so it sounds like the source, which is apropos, is it? He's like, yeah, it's exactly what it sounds like. I was like, well, that makes sense. I'd like to give you a t-shirt, too, from our film festival. That's for you coming out. You got a t-shirt. Congratulations.
<I'll take>
Thank you, Brandon. Thank you guys so much. for coming. As you know, like, since we started it, God, we started the Film Society in 2011. Is that right? My brain. Wow. Okay. We've been doing that for a while. So it's always been a goal to get Q&As out here. So we're glad, and we want to do more of this and get more filmmakers out here. So if you guys have any suggestions about which filmmakers you'd like to see, we'll hit up Spielberg next. Justin Bieber? Is that what you said?
Justin Bieber.
Oh, Justin Bieber. Oh, yeah, he better submit to the festival.